Hello, this is Truth Be Told Transformation, and I'm your host, Bonnie Burkert. So, happiness, it's something that seems quite elusive nowadays, and I think oftentimes we're looking for it outside of ourselves. Today, I've invited a very wise guest to talk a little bit more about this. Welcome, Ira Israel.
So nice to be here, Bonnie. Thank you.
Hi. So, happiness spectrum. Let's talk about what that, how the word spectrum applies to what we're talking about and how to get to happiness.
For me, there's two origins of a happiness spectrum. First is positive psychology, Martin Seligman, University of Pennsylvania. It's part of that. And then there's a funny, there was a study done. It's called it's called accident victims and lottery winners. And one time when I was teaching, I made a terrible slip and I said accident winners and lottery victims. Because if you do the studies on people who won the lottery, and this is part of the study, the original study. Things that we think will make us happy do for like 6 to 18 months, and then our minds are like hedonic treadmills, and that whatever we desire, once it's replaced by another desire, and we underestimate our resilience. So these people who were in accidents like me, but I wasn't part of the study, they say, oh, if I had scars on my face, I would never do this or whatever. But whatever level of happiness people were at before winning the lottery or before an accident, 18 months later, they were back to it. So we underestimate our resilience, and we overestimate the things. Like if you say, I'll be happy forever if I get married, or I'll be happy forever if I get divorced, or I'll be happy forever if I win the lottery or have a child or whatever, statistically, it's not accurate.
I just think that is so fascinating. And I mean, I could go down this whole path of the winning lotto. You know, and I'm like, but I know I'd be happy if I won lotto. I would do good. I'm already like, I have a whole checklist of what I would do with it. And
let me just say this. This is a funny thing. There's a quote. This is apocryphal. It was F. Scott Fitzgerald said, "Rich people are different from you and me." And then Hemingway supposedly said, "They have more money." So, meaning that there's just a different set of problems. There was a New York Times article, but now it's probably 15 years old, where all these lottery winners, and if you've been around high net worth people, you really can't trust anybody. Like, you can't trust that at some point in time, they're not going to say, oh my God, I need a new liver. Can you just wire $50,000 to my account?
Yeah.
There's a downside. And again, if you want to know, or spin this around to happiness, it's like, let's look at the things that are causing us to be stressed out instead.
Yeah, I think that would be a great place to start, because we could kind of do that sort of, mine that issue of,
Why aren't we happy?
Yeah. But I do think, let's get to some foundations. And what have you found in life? You're out there writing and teaching. Ira teaches at a beautiful location at Esalen Institute, which is on the coast in Central California. It's like just one of the dreamiest places in the world. And you're informing people so wisely. So what are some of the things that you talk about? Because I know you lecture on happiness there as well, right?
So the only thing that correlates strongly with happiness is the quality of your intimate relationships. Basically, can you securely attach to people? And for me, the problem is that the only thing that correlates strongly with being able to attach securely to people is being authentic. But you're raised in this crazy society where you're taught to like always smile, put your best foot forward. You have this whole, unseemly to you probably, like, oh, if people knew my real inside thoughts, they would, I'd be locked up or, whatever. And then you're out there as a business person and you're selling things and you're selling yourself and you're marketing. And so you're always putting this other side forward. So, again, if you want to be happy, that really you need to just build loving, secure relationships. And we suck at that in this country. Like, we do see other people as like wallets with legs. And Los Angeles is a horrifying place for that. Like,
oh my God.
Because there's always it's really bad. I mean, when 30 years ago, before cell phones, I lived in Paris, and I'm still friends with all the people. There were no cell phones. You'd have to run to a payphone and call and leave a message. And then, and the thing I realized about those relationships when I was in my 20s is that nobody was trying to do business. It's really interesting. And then I make a joke about Los Angeles, and I say, you only want to do business with your friends because you trust them, but most of the time when you do business with them, it destroys the relationship.
It's true.
So it's, you know, it's we need to learn how to have these loving dinner parties, which I throw at Esalen for 70 people, and you just sit there, and the only thing I would suggest is don't talk about business. Mm. Don't talk about like how you earn
what
a living.
You do, right?
What you
because
do.
I remember I was in New York City for a lot of years, and I worked in the record business, and it was always like what label you worked for. So
right,
it was
exactly.
like a whole nother level. Not only did you have this like I'm in entertainment, I'm in music, I'm in at this label. It was crazy. That was my identity.
Yeah.
And when I left and I moved to Mexico, I lived in Cancun for a year, and nobody ever talked about what they did for a living down there. And I mean, I was, I wasn't just hanging with beach bums. I was for sure with people that were in the professional world, but it wasn't something that came up. So I definitely
It used to be considered vulgar, you know? Mm. And now in our culture, like particularly two men, it's like when they meet, what's your name? Well, like, where are you from? What do you do? And for me, Carolyn Mace talks about this. Like, we're always searching for our tribe, and so we're like we want to know: can we trust this person, or do we have to, you know, be worried that at some point in time they're gonna, you know, screw us? No.
Well, no, it's weird as you're describing that. I'm thinking sort of. The tribe in terms of long ago,
right.
You know, our forefathers,
people. Right.
Well, our forefathers and just how people related to each other
right.
In primal ways.
And I'll just tell you, see, the reason that you wouldn't screw somebody is because if you did and got caught, you would be thrown out of the tribe, right? And then the other tribes would kill you. So in our society, we don't have that anymore. So we try to build tribes, but if we get thrown out, we kind of like, oh, I'll just make friends at the gym. I did something bad at the gym.
Wow.
I'll just go to whatever.
Yoga so, class.
Nobody ever does anything bad in yoga classes.
Oh, my God. No, it's so true.
Sorry.
Okay, so I'm going to take it back, though, to relationships, because this is one, okay, and you've got, I read a great article about 20 tools, you know,
right.
to use to get ourselves on the happiness spectrum.
Yep.
And meaning you can be sort of happy or you can start to really feel.
Well, I'll just refine that. So tools, right? So there are scientifically proven tools that keep people at the high end of their happiness spectrum. And then, you know, if you drink gin for breakfast, that's going to keep you at the low end. Like, we know these things. Like, if you mouth off to police officers, like, if you, like, there's just certain things that are just, you know, like, if you.
It's just like low vibe.
Well, it's just but there are, from positive psychology, we know what keeps people happy. And it's unfortunate in our culture that we're really misguided. I mean, in Sonia Lyubomirsky's work, The How of Happiness, she says, like, renters are statistically happier than homeowners.
Wow.
Statistically. And so, everyone in Los Angeles, it's like there's been this craze for years, low interest rates. I remember when in the 70s, like interest rates were like 16%. And then, you know, since Ronald Reagan and everybody, it's just like, Robert Reich writes about this. In the 1950s, the American dream was like, be a good neighbor. Like be a part of a neighborhood, build something.
Community.
All right, community.
Yeah.
And then it transmuted into homeownership. And even George Bush after 9/11 famously said, or George Bush too, you know, go shopping. So like the things that don't make us happy, they're kind of just like these weird addictions, like cryptocurrency or checking our net worth in the morning.
Facebook likes.
Checking your Facebook likes, your status, things like that.
Yeah.
The article I just read this morning in the New York Times was that the out of 27 things, like social media comes in 27th in terms of correlating with happiness. Like it actually makes people miserable.
Yeah, I know. And yet we're happy when we see you there. So, all right. So one of the tools on this particular article that I saw you write, and again, if you Google Ira, there's lots of information that he's got out there for you, as well as you can work with Ira. But it goes back to, I mean, we know each other from the yoga world. And so always the suggestion to breath. And so I think that, you know, you spoke about a morning practice, not gin, but rather right. at least, at the very least, tuning in
right.
and doing so, I think, with breath. So maybe you'd like to give us a little bit of how you work with that.
It's very difficult to be happy if you're in fight or flight mode. Mm-hmm. And the things that we consider to be normal in our culture, whether it's sitting, right? So I'm all compressed in here right now.
Right.
And I sit in my car or in my chair for 9/10 of my waking hours, right? I'm sitting. That's not great. Coffee. Obviously, we don't eat meat, but like meat, flesh, like sugar, which, you know, carbohydrates, all these things that we do in our culture that we consider to be normal. I mean, this is the funniest thing in the world to me. If you want to torture somebody, you shock them intermittently so they can't be aware of this. Mm-hmm. And we have these things in our phone, in our pockets, like that shock us intermittently. Like we are in fight or flight mode. All the time. Like, I mean, I turn off notifications, like, because statistically, this is something called science, right? So, like, scientifically, you want to torture someone, shock them intermittently. So, if you have your thing on and you're constantly, like, buzz,
incoming text, notification, or earthquake,
it's just like being tortured, but you're doing it to yourself. So, coffee, sugar, I mean, I'm not going for sainthood in this life. You know, I have my coffee right here. I have my cell phone right here. You know, like
I'm not going for sainthood.
I had a glass of wine with my pasta last night. You know, so I'm not saying like you have to do these things. I'm just saying, for me this morning, I meditated, and I know from my DVDs that our inhalations, if we're like this, are about 4 seconds in and about 5 seconds out. And so what I try to do when I teach is double that and create an anchor so that you know later in the day when you get a cutoff on the 134 coming here, that you have a choice. You know, your natural reaction is maladaptive. All of our natural reactions to things are actually maladaptive. And then when you can breathe and then choose, you know, that's where autonomy and agency come in. And that's where people who have autonomy and can they have enough freedom to make the decisions. We're not slaves, you know, in our culture, except our own personal enslavement to, you know, getting bigger bank accounts or whatever we're trying to do that we think is normal and rational. And then the agency is being able to enact those choices. So for me, again, like the setting the anchor in the morning, not drinking the gin, setting the anchor in the morning of just...
It's grounding.
So we're normally just breathing into the diaphragm, like right down here. So mm-hmm. when I teach the three-part breath, the second part goes into your sides of your ribs. And then the third part of your lung is actually at your clavicle.
That's much higher.
It's much higher than you think. So when you sip in that extra part and then fluidly release it, I think it only takes about 2 minutes of to get you out of fight or flight mode. So when you're triggered, and as in my book, we all have a wounded child in us, and there's weird things that trigger us, like being disrespected by the cashier at Whole Foods might bring up your daddy issues. You know, like you don't know your own subconscious. So like throughout the day, you're triggered, and you can make a choice on how to react. Rather than, and that's Viktor Frankl's great quote, obviously, between stimuli and reaction, you have a choice.
Yes. Okay. So that's great. So to, I think, you know, we talked about a morning practice with breathing, but I think we need to do it all the time. I know when I'm waiting for something to download and I'm like, oh, I'm hurry, you know, or slow internet or something like that. I always use that time for breath and you know, a stretch.
Yeah. And for people who are particularly stressed out, what I recommend is like the top of every hour. Mm-hmm. This is really funny. I'm going to contradict myself. I had one person set their alarm. Is it now that I think about it, like stupid. But for just as a pattern interrupt, do 1 minute of like Ujjayi breathing, like at the top of every hour. Like at their desk, just stand up and take those full, deep, expansive breaths.
Stand up like that. And also inhaling, exhaling through the nose.
Yeah.
So let's just go ahead and remind that. So, all right. And now you referenced your book. So I've got it here. And Tony's going to also show with a better picture how to survive your childhood now that you're an adult. All right. So you mentioned, you know, daddy issues and just as one. But
this is good. So there's a chapter in the book that says every child should say, my parents did the best they could with the tools they had at the time. So I just want to steer away from blaming, because that's a whole other. Then because I'm teaching forgiveness.
Right. I mean, because then it's just the story. It's just you know, people are just completely sort of retelling their story over and over again. And so tell us a little bit about this book though, and how it informs our happiness, because I feel that you were talking about relationships, right? And so certainly our relationship with our parents affect our relationships in the here and now. So
I teach attachment theory, and there are four types of attachment. There was John Bowlby in the 60s in London, and then Mary Ainsworth in 1969 did these experiments called the strain situation. And a mom and her baby would be in a room, and then the mom would leave, and the baby would do one of a couple of different things, and then the mom would come back in. And so Mary Ainsworth found that 33% of babies securely reattach to their mom. Basically, they learned subconsciously that the world was a safe place, their mom wasn't going to put them in harm's way, and they didn't freak out when their mom left them, right? I actually think that those statistics have gone way down, because and with our phones, the other extreme is avoidant. And people, it's an epidemic, because you can swipe left and it like gives you this sense of power. It's like a dopamine hit, like to sit there and swipe left. Everybody knows what I'm saying, right? Which is a funny thing. Like if you went to like a Papua New Guinea today and said like, do you guys swipe left? Like, but you and I, we know what it means, right? You're telling someone fuck off, like even... you know, whatever. Or ghosting them. Also, like, just like, oh, wow, I'm so powerful. I don't have to respond. The emperor's new clothes.
I know.
It's ridiculous. It's so, the culture we live in and the little, what we consider to be. Anyways, let me go back to happiness and attachment theory. So avoidant attachment, essentially, the mom leaves. The baby cries itself out or freaks out a little bit. And then when the mom comes back in, the baby's like, well, fuck you. You left and it hurt. And if I reattach, it's just going to happen again. Mm. So for the next 60 years, I'll just swipe left.
Wow.
And that's the culture we live in, because in the 60s, like Dr. Spock, you know, like nobody was breastfed. They went to our parents and they said, this chemical is superior to mother's milk. And our parents believed them, right? 1966. And then Dr. Spock also was like, let the baby cry itself out. I mean, we have attachment parenting now where the baby's like sleeping with the parents and things like that. We've gone to another extreme. And there's pluses and minuses. Again, it's just styles. But we, as people of a certain age, we have to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps and recognize why we think the shit that we think, and why we have these overreactions at Whole Foods. I don't know why I'm using that as an example. I should use Air One, or like driving on the 134, or like these things. And then, you know, like choose authenticity, choose who you want to be, rather than just be a bundle of reactions, because as I prove in my courses, most of our those are the things that we consider to be like a normal reaction. Like, it's a normal reaction for me to give someone the finger if they cut me off on the 134, right? Like, no, that's not. That's maladaptive. You could get shot. You could lose control of your car. It's just stupid. And yet most of the things that we think are normal, like, oh, I'm stressed out, I'll go have a drink, or I'll smoke a joint. Like, no, that's a depressant. Like, mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. I know. Okay, so, wow, it's loaded, and it's really fascinating. And I feel we're giving some examples. We're giving many examples of how there are issues. And so I want to bring it back to the show and sort of a purpose that I have here. Because I refer to tools for transformation, mm-hmm. right? To live your highest truth. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? Truth. And I want to invite everybody to look at that and realize one of the ways, a definition would be authenticity. And so I think that it also comes back to what we were talking about before with breath, yeah. being present. So being in the present moment. So if somebody cuts you off in traffic, you're fine. So bringing it back to, right. And I mean, maybe that's not a great example because you're in that fight or flight example. So if somebody cuts you off, they've probably startled you.
Hold on a second. I noticed that you're not a man. So like men, when things like that happen, like feel emasculated. Mm. And so that's why they have these, because we're taught, like we play football, we're taught to like have this way of being in the world, which is kind of aggressive. Mm. And I think it's fed by capitalism, you know, whether it's, or, you know, in sports or the army or things like that. So that's why the example is okay, I think.
Okay, that it can be. Well, no, in response, and believe me, I do too. I always say, I've said this many, many times, and it's really funny. For all of our listeners, you can tell we're in Los Angeles because we talk about traffic a lot. I mean, it seems to come up regularly in our interviews. And I always say it's the highest form of yoga is to not lose it in traffic. And because what is yoga? It is that link to the divine. And you're a practitioner, you teach yoga, mm-hmm. and I know that it's a big part of your life. And so with the breath, right? And so it's just, I think it's sort of shifting out of maybe this worldly craziness and sort of taking a loftier view of life.
Okay. And I'll tell you a funny joke. George Carlin said, there's only two types of drivers. There are lunatics and idiots. The lunatics are the people behind you who want to go faster, and the idiots are the people in front of you who are going too slow. So, but it's an interesting thing because what I study is consciousness, the human mind, and how we categorize things. And that'll lead us into a discussion about Vedanta and the birth of yoga and why we practice meditation and yoga. Our yoga for me is just a moving meditation because we're trying to transcend our thinking apparatus, go to the other side of our thoughts, and there, the French word is réaliser, but it's realize in English, but it really means to become one with your authentic self, your higher self, or whatever you believe is divine. And then that relates to our earlier conversation about like parapsychology, remote viewing, and what's really going on, and then what we take in and the way our mind filters it. You know, what you don't know that you don't know is infinite. You know, like we all don't know infinite things, and language is a cage. We're trapped in one or two languages, most of us, you know, and like we just have to be a lot more compassionate and deferential to our situation. And you see that fundamentalism and, you know, the Russians and the Ukrainians or the Catholics and the Protestants and in Ireland, there's just like all these breaking up into tribes, you know, like it's really.
It does boil down to that in such a big way. I mean, look at all over this country, it's tribalism. Awful. I mean, you know, based on, we've even got colors to inform that. So, that part is really hard.
I know I was watching something on YouTube last night, and these people were, I was watching John Oliver, and they showed some politicians, and they were talking about liberals, people like in a really derogatory way. And I was just thinking like, wow, when did that shift come? Like, why can't like you be conservative? You want to conserve the white male Christian hegemony, and I think that, you know, I'm a progressive, so I want to, you know, everyone, we don't have a hierarchical, you know, situation, but then we have to decide, like, how we're going to live together without feudalism or the king or what we consider to be democracy, which is really an oligarchy. So, like, how can we have a realistic conversation? And that's the problem with our country, is, like, we're not having the right conversations. We're just calling each other names.
It's true. All right. So, again, we're looking for some
yoga
solutions here, right?
Let's go back to that.
I know. Well, right.
Go ahead.
And, I mean, you mentioned Vedanta. So, mm-hmm. I'd love to invite you to bring – to yeah.
So, there's five terms that are essential. So, the first is Brahman with an A, Brahman. Brahman. And the best definition I heard of it was from Barbara Holdridge at UCSB. She said, that without attributes is a good translation. But what I teach is, if you can think it, it's not it. Mm. Right? So it's if you can think it, it's not it. Right? Yeah. You can also consider, if you need an analogy, you can think of the Matrix. Right? Or something like that. Mm. Right? Okay. So the second term is Atman. And the best translation is soul. But if you look in all the written translations, it's always capital S self, so your higher self. So either one works. So there's Brahman, Atman, there's Maya, which I would translate as illusory, not illusion, but illusory, because that correlates to the fact that everything's ephemeral. You know, we get attached to certain things, but, like, it's all just passing. This too shall pass, right?
Yeah.
And then samsara is the fourth term. Just means the wheel of life. Mm. If you believe in reincarnation, I won't go into it now, but Ian Stevenson from the University of Virginia documented thousands of cases of children who remember their past lives.
Yeah.
And then the fifth term everybody knows, which is karma. The law of action and reaction. So yoga and meditation were devised and designed to help you transcend Maya, which is everything that you get in through your five senses and chunk into a narrative, like I am Maya, I am 5'11", I weigh 178 pounds, whatever. You transcend that, you disidentify that to realize that Atman equals Brahman. Your higher self, your soul, is the universe, God, everythingness. That's the point of yoga. Anyone who's doing yoga for better abs or better butts, I'll stop myself there. So the purpose of yoga is to transcend, you know, it's a moving meditation, so you can transcend Maya, your thinking apparatus, and realize, like, the nectar, the bliss of being alive, you know?
I mean, I feel it works, but
yeah, I
do. I'm a big believer, so.
Yeah. Well, again, you're in a society that keeps you in fight or flight mode, and you, at some point in time, realized, probably when you were in Cancun after being stressed out in New York, you know, that, like, wow, like this way of being that I created to ride the subways of New York, which is you have to be a kind of a, I mean, I was there in the 80s, like, you have to be a kind of badass.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, I was. You know? I was all of that. No, it's true, but there came a point where I realized that I couldn't keep doing it.
It takes a lot of energy.
Well, I was studying a lot of Ayurveda at that point. I mean, just, you know, sort of general, but I was having an awakening around that and what that meant and sister science to yoga, and I invite everybody to look into that as well. But, yeah, I just realized that I wouldn't be able to stay much longer in the city and live that way. And it wasn't it wasn't physical. It was also the games that needed to be played to climb the corporate ladder. And, you know, it's a stress factor, basically. But it was stress avoidance, I think, and just for my well-being.
Yeah.
But is that a, okay.
It's a problem in our society because of the, we inherited measures of success and a paradigm of happiness, which is completely fictitious. And I treat a lot of people, and I tell them, like, the core wounds are abandonment and betrayal. And the way they manifest societally is that we were promised, if you go to a good school and get good grades, you'll get a good job, you'll marry a very beautiful person, and you'll buy a home and have 2.3 kids, and she'll drive a Subaru, and you can have a fancier car, and you'll be happy. And all of my peers did that.
Dog. Don't forget the dog.
Oh, fuck. I forgot the dog. I'm a cat person. That's why. All of my friends did that, and they weren't happy. And that registers as a betrayal because you did everything right. You lived up to, you know, your someone, your parents probably, or the Brady Bunch, whatever you saw
Walt
on
Disney,
social media, whatever,
yeah.
Their measure of success for like the good life. And you didn't create it yourself. So for me, like, I help people embrace their own autonomy. And then I empower them to be agents and to create their great lives. And it's not, you know, it's not like five big houses, like, you know, because, you know, those who possess little actually are that much less possessed. That's a quote from Nietzsche. But like, the people who want more and more stuff, like, it's just more and more headaches.
Yeah, it's really true. I think courage to walk one's path.
Exactly.
So I think one is sort of identifying what that path might look
right, like,
and some of it is releasing.
And the word for me is vocation. So there's three things you can do as an adult. And this is Sonia Lubomirsky's work. So I just want to tell people to read that book. The first thing you can do as an adult is a job. And that's something you do for money. And statistically, anyone who has a job is miserable, as we know from the pandemic. And 8% of people, the New York Times reported last week, have gone back to work full time. Like, because we're not, the 40-hour work week says it's 100 years old. It's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. Like, people would rather have their autonomy and walk around in their pajamas and eat cereal at 12 o'clock and do their hour of work a day. Sitting in a cubicle someplace doesn't make you more productive. So the first thing you can do as an adult is have a job. Those people are miserable. Second thing you can do as an adult have a career, and those people are miserable but slightly less miserable. And the third thing you can do as an adult is know your vocation. So voco in Latin means calling. What is the universe calling you to do?
Nice.
So from the Bhagavad Gita, if we're talking about yoga, the fortune cookie to take from the Bhagavad Gita is follow your dharma, right? Dharma is how is the universe operating, and then how you as an individual relate to that. But Joseph Campbell put it more succinctly and beautiful. He said, follow your bliss.
Okay.
So the things that make you blissful, and it's usually connecting with other people, helping other people, being authentic, feeling heard, knowing how to make someone else feel heard. There's just I've just written the second book, and I think we should teach like 8-year-olds like hugging classes and breathing classes.
I know.
They don't need to learn biology.
I go back to yoga. I mean, right. Why couldn't yoga be the gym that they have? I mean, I understand that there need to be sports, but something like some yoga work.
There's just so many other things. Like, our school system was built to make factory workers. And our school system was built to make factory workers, and it's antiquated, just like the CHAD system on our ballots, you know,
right.
like we should all be voting by our phone by now and through blockchain. But like, all these changes are obvious, but we fear change. And then the theme of the first book is, you know, power corrupts. So whoever gets into power, once you get into power, like, you have all these ideals, like I do, you know, and then if someone just wired $100 million to my bank account, like, I might be corrupted. I don't know. You have to, you know, but you have to be open to that. Like, surely not. Surely not me. That's really funny. No, but you're susceptible unless, like the people who say, I'm not a narcissist, are narcissists. Like, that's why you have to be able to entertain all these possibilities. Like, you have to be able to say, wow, that's really interesting. I wrote an article about this called The Best Article Ever Written by a Narcissist. Because, you know, all of us psychotherapists, we end up quoting ourselves on Instagram and put like Ira Israel, he said this very profound thing, you know, like whatever. And it's gross.
I don't agree.
It's fucking gross, man.
Well, okay, but that's where, I mean, all that is, it's, I mean.
Me quoting myself, like I'm.
It's self-promotion.
Right, well, but that's what, but at the end of the day, it doesn't make people happy. That's what I'm saying.
You're not quoting yourself. You're sharing some of your wisdom a social media platform. I give you, you know.
You give me license.
Reign. Yeah, I give you license to quote yourself.
I hope that Instagram goes the way of the fax machine and in my lifetime, and that at the end.
It probably will.
I hope so.
I mean, we'll see. People will be watching YouTube instead, watching shows like this to learn and hopefully feel better. I mean, I think that we're really identifying a lot of things that are going wrong, that we're doing wrong, and yet I don't know. I think vocation. I really like what you just said there. Now, there are people that feel like they need the security of a steady job playing that game. So maybe they just know that how to kind of work around it and not fall into the dark hole of corporate politics.
Again, it all revolves around autonomy.
Right.
Having enough freedom to make decisions. And if you understand that, like, you're a worker bee, then, like, embrace it and just know, like, I want to be of service. This is how I can do it. Like, I don't want to be in front of the camera. I want to be behind the camera, you know.
Right. And don't be defined, I want to say. Don't be defined by that work, because people are going to have to work. So, but maybe
I don't understand why you would say that.
I don't know. I guess just from a productivity standpoint for our.
Well, we could have a universal basic income and we could all be artists. The problem is that, I mean, capitalism is a system of exploitation and oppression. And we don't know. I mean, Malcolm Harris says that the primary goal of capital is to pay labor as little as possible. And this is what Thomas Piketty talks about in his two books, and he just came out with a third. But that's why we have this disparity, and this is why we can't talk to each other, because of all this exploitation that has happened from slavery all the way up through today. It's happening right now and it's really weird what the pandemic has done, because when I go to yoga on Saturday morning, I go by this Wendy's from where I park, and they have these signs like, we need employees, $20 an hour. And like when I was in high school, like it was like $3.25. And they can't find people, because people have learned in some ways, like flipping burgers or whatever you do. It's like, it's, you know, yeah, if you, and it's interesting because mortgages, like if you get yourself into 30 years of indebtedude, then you cannot quit your job, you know. So that's that we have to realize how we're enslaving ourselves with going to college. Let's say, you know, the average college student now leaves with $29,000 worth of debt, you know. So we have this system, and there are people who are looking for, you know, as soon as you say something negative about capitalism, someone says, what are you, some kind of socialist? And they usually make an error and conflate that with communism, and then you know they're an idiot, but it doesn't matter. So, because socialism and communism are not the same. So, but there's a third way, and that's coming, and we can't see it, you know? We just don't know. Like, that's why I'm saying, like, we get our personal identity if they work, and we think we have to be productive members of society, but we're not happy as a culture.
Okay.
So, like, yeah, maybe, I don't know what the answer is. I just know that for the people in my life, like, if they're really depressed or anxious, I try to inspire them to embrace their autonomy, you know, and choose certain things, that tools that keep them at the high end of their happiness spectrum and be agents of their lives and be artists, you know, be creative, like create your art as if you're create your life as if you're creating a sculpture or a symphony.
Follow your dreams. I actually had an interview where I shared my life story, and it was really truly just about that. It was following signs that were, you know, for me about sort of transcending that day-to-day,
right.
being in slavery, I suppose.
It was in
my own mind. There was always a time. I mean, I could have easily. I finally got it together
That's why it has to be looked at as an addiction, because you're like, and the young people today who understand that experiences are more important than possessions are a lot smarter than my generation. On your deathbed, you will remember walking through Paris at 5 a.m. and watching the sun come up, and you will not remember the handbag that was on your arm. Like, it's
what shoes you were wearing.
Right.
Oh, that's good.
When you go to a cafe, do you sit around and talk about, I had this amazing shopping victory. I went to the Neiman Marcus black store. What is that?
I don't know.
Thing?
I'm not
Everyone
that girl.
Talks about, like, the,
I'm
the,
not that
the
girl.
Shopping victories. And I'm just like,
I got this scarf in Rishikesh for $1.
Yeah. I had these beads that I bought at the Hare Krishna temple in Delhi, and people were always fascinated by them. And they were like, how'd you get those? And I said, hey, it's a great story. I went to the Hare Krishna temple, and lunch was 45 cents, and I felt bad, so I wanted to spend a whole dollar. So I got the beads for 55 cents, and they were like, they look like
incredible.
Very expensive.
Right,
they're
exactly.
55
if you
cents
bought them here, they would be
more
amazing.
For 20 years.
Well, Ira, there's so much to learn and know. So you want to leave us with any final thoughts on finding that happiness and staying there?
I think that we have to take a look at the arrogance of the human mind and recognize its own foibles. And any type of dogmatism, fundamentalism, you know, trying to inflict your beliefs on somebody else is really what's caused all these schisms and caused this tribalization. And we have to, you know, be the change we want to see in the world and learn how to show up in more loving and compassionate ways than the culture that we're living in, which is based on, you know, competition and the zero-sum game of survival of the fittest from Herbert Spencer. And it basically winds up making people miserable because they either make Faustian pacts and they sell their soul in order to make a lot of money, and they realize that doesn't make them happy, but then they're locked into the system. You know, it's just like the pharmaceutical. All these systems have been corrupted. And they all started with Instagram. Like, there were certain things, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, my favorite example is Monsanto, right? Who we all hate now, legitimately. But when they started, all those engineers, like, they were called by McDonald's. McDonald's said, hey, we're having a problem making the buns the same consistency in Alaska and Florida. Can you do something to, you know, make the wheat come up to be whatever? And 30 years later, it's Roundup. But the guys who started that and the scientists who were like, wow, this is cool, man. We can do this thing. It was like revolutionary. Just like we thought like cigarettes in the 50s were good for you, you know? No. Like, we have to understand, like, this is like we're on this evolution, and we're just a part of it. And so there's no reason to be, you know, fundamentalist and dogmatist.
Right. And so we're part of the evolution.
Right.
And show up for it as peacefully as you can.
Exactly. I mean, compassion is it.
Yeah. Yes? Okay. Let's try. All right. Well, until the next time, I want to let everybody know that you can find Ira at iraisrael.com quite simply. Lots of videos to watch, books to read, and articles for us as well. Thank you for joining us today. It was fascinating, and there's so much more
to
discuss. Until the next time, for sure. So thanks for listening, everybody. Again, I'm Bonnie Burkert. This is Truth Be Told Transformation. We want to share the tools for higher truth. I hope that you have some takeaways. And if so, please be sure that you follow us and share. And also be sure to watch Mondays at 3. Robert Hensley is there with the Minuteman Report. And, of course, Fridays at 3 Pacific with the original Truth Be Told, Tony Sweet. Until the next time, be well, everybody, and peace.